Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns over the air and online at koacountry1077.com and at lava1053.com. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Good morning. Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues. We're here every Sunday morning, 6:30 a.m. Koa Country, 107.7 FM, and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. You may also listen to the podcasts of this Island Issues and past Island Issues at lava1053.com and at koacountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. I'm excited today to bring you part one of a two-part interview with five-time space shuttle astronaut Jeff Hoffman. Every November, the International Lunar Observatory Association in Waimea holds what's called a Galaxy Forum to talk about various space issues, and I moderated the one last November. I was honored to do so. And by happenstance, Jeff Hoffman happened to be there, and he graciously agreed to sit down and record an interview. So we did that at Canada-France Hawaii Telescope. Many thanks to Doug Simons for letting us use his conference room. And I want to say, as I was getting this ready to get on the air in the last couple of days, wow, I so enjoyed talking with Jeff Hoffman, and I hope you enjoy this week and next week as much as I have. Let's get to part one of my conversation with astronaut Jeff Hoffman. So I'm here now. We're recording an interview at Canada-France Hawaii Telescope, and I'm with astronaut, or at least former astronaut, Jeff Hoffman. Good morning. Aloha, Jeff.
Aloha. It's hard to know whether to say formal. Some people say once an astronaut, always an astronaut. I was actually a NASA astronaut from 1978 through 1997, and then I've gone on to do other things.
But I'd say always an astronaut. I mean, when I met you, and I actually, for the listeners, I met Jeff at the International Lunar Observatory Association Forum in Waimea on November 9th. And let me tell you, the people in the audience were as delighted as I was to find that we had always an astronaut in the audience. So, Jeff, I'm curious, and something that I'd like to have you share for any particularly young listeners in our audience, what was your basic summary of your education and career path that got you to be an astronaut?
Well, I grew up in New York City in the suburbs of New York, and my dad used to take me pretty regularly to the planetarium. And I mean, we went to lots of museums and other cultural things, but somehow looking up at those planets and stars seemed just to click with my personality. And I guess my dad recognized that, which is why he kept taking me back there. And he was kind of interested in astronomy too. We had a little telescope. And from the age of six, I was just fascinated by the stars and the planets. And I'm old enough, that was actually before Sputnik was launched, so it was really around the birth of the space age. We had lots of excitement back then. Space was in the news, the coming of the space age, and television shows, and magazine, and newspaper articles, and I was very excited. I mean, I remember going out with my dad to the local high school football field and watching Sputnik fly over, and the excitement when Yuri Gagarin and Alan Shepard and John Glenn flew in space. And I always thought, gee, this would be really, really a neat thing to do. All the early astronauts, though, were military test pilots, and that wasn't a career that I was interested in. But I was good in school. I liked math, science. I mean, I did well in all the subjects, but I had a good technical background, and, you know, here in Hawaii, with all the astronomy things going on, there's lots of opportunities for kids to get excited, and really, I encourage parents, if your children show any enthusiasm for space, for astronomy, take advantage of all the things here, because you never know when you light a little spark in a child and it can grow into a fire, and who knows where it will take you. I mean, in my case, it took me into space eventually. But as I said, all the early astronauts were military test pilots. I continued with my interest in physics, astronomy, majored in that in college, went on to get a doctorate in astrophysics. And the kind of astrophysics I was doing actually was associated with space, because with the advent of the space age and the ability to put telescopes above the atmosphere, we could look at radiation that we can't observe from the ground, even from the top of Mauna Kea, X-rays, gamma rays, hard ultraviolet don't get down to the ground, which is a good thing for us because they're kind of nasty for people, but they're very interesting for astronomers. So I spent the first part of my professional career actually building telescopes and launching them up above the atmosphere using high-altitude balloons, sounding rockets, and eventually satellites. I was working at MIT in the late 70s with satellite astronomy projects when, at that time, NASA was developing this, what was then the brand new space shuttle. And this was a very different vehicle. It had a crew of up to 7 people, but you only needed 2 pilots, sort of like in a commercial airplane. So when NASA realized, you know, we need a lot more astronauts because most of the astronauts from the Apollo program had left, and they put out a call for applications saying, we don't just need pilots, we want scientists, engineers, medical doctors. And that was my chance. I put in my application, and of course, 8,000 other people put in applications as well. Luckily, not only was I very well qualified, because there were a lot of very well qualified people, but I guess I did everything right in the interviews, and who knows what goes on behind the doors when they're selecting astronauts. Well, I know a little bit because I've actually been on selection panels, and I was very fortunate. I got selected as one of the group of the first shuttle astronauts. There were 35 of us, 15 pilots, all military, and 20 what we called mission specialists. These were the scientists, engineers. Among them was Ellison Amezuka, who I know is very well known here in Hawaii. He was one of our group. Wonderful guy. Every year he used to hold a big luau for the rest of us and, you know, dig a big pit with the hot stones and put a pig in there. Oh, he was wonderful. And of course, tragically, we lost him in the Challenger accident, along with several other of my classmates. It was a very, very tragic thing. But we all knew that there were dangers involved in space flights, and we did pick up the pieces and went on from there. I had made one space flight before Challenger. My second flight actually was scheduled to be the very next flight after the Challenger, so we were very close to that crew. There's kind of a tradition in the astronaut office that the family of the next crew in line, sort of, they give a party for the family of the prime crew, and they sort of, we got quite close, so it was very traumatic for everybody, of course, but particularly for us and our families. But as I say, we recovered, and I went on to have 4 more space flights after that. And certainly the high point of my career as an astronaut must be the repair and rescue of the Hubble Space Telescope in 1993, which is long enough ago that all of my students, now I'm a professor at MIT, they weren't even born when Hubble was put up into space, and it's been so successful since we fixed it that they don't realize what a disaster it was when we put this billion-dollar telescope up in orbit and it couldn't focus properly. But certainly one of the great thrills of my life, both as an astronomer and an astronaut, was putting my own 2 hands on the Hubble Space Telescope in space and then fixing it. And, you know, for years after I came back, my old astronomer friends, whenever they would see me, they'd say, "Oh, Jeff, thank you so much for fixing Hubble." And my response was always, "It was a pleasure." And it truly was. It was one of the high points of my career.
I would imagine that. I mean, and also it was not just a high point of your career, but it was significant for the world. Now, I know that you're involved with NASA still, and I want to talk more about your astronaut career. But first, I want to ask you, you are here on Hawaii Island, and you're actually involved in a project that is a NASA project inside Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. Tell us what this project is.
It's called BASALT, which is a complicated acronym, but it's related to volcanoes, which is why they chose that acronym. You know, NASA is now thinking seriously about someday, I don't know exactly when, but someday sending humans to Mars. Exploring Mars is going to be very different from exploring the moon, because when astronauts were on the moon, of course, they went there as part of the Apollo program. It was the Cold War era, and we were going there to beat the Russians. But I think to its credit, NASA said, well, as long as we're going to the moon, let's do some serious science. And the astronauts received training in geology from professional geologists. And while they were on the moon, they had cameras that they would transmit pictures back to the Earth. And there was a whole back room full of geologists and other scientists who would communicate with the astronauts to try to, they'd look at rocks that they pick up and try to decide, you know, is this something that you should bring back as a sample, because they were limited in how many samples they could bring back, and basically guiding them. So there was a very close communication between people on the Earth and people on the moon, which the moon is not that far away. I mean, it's by earthly standards, it is. It's 250,000 miles. It takes 3 days to get there, but that's nothing like Mars. And the communications by radio, of course, travel at the speed of light, which from the moon takes, you know, a little more than a second. So you can have a pretty reasonable conversation between the Earth and the moon. But not so with Mars, because Mars is tens of millions of miles away, depending on where the Earth and Mars are in their orbits. And so the communication time is tens of minutes. So you can't have a real conversation. And when, you know, if an astronaut on Mars picks up a rock, wants to show it to people on the Earth to find out whether it's a useful thing to collect, and has to wait 20 or 30 minutes for a reply, you know, that's going to be very inefficient. Time is incredibly valuable when you're on the moon or on Mars, when you look at what it costs to put somebody there. You need more efficient ways of doing exploration, and that's what we're trying to set up here. So this field exercise on the volcano is actually a real scientific mission. We are trying to learn things about the composition of the lava, and in particular some of the biota, some of the life forms that are living there. So we have people who are, we'll call them the pseudo-astronauts, who go out. They're not wearing spacesuits, but they are carrying backpacks with all sorts of communications equipment, television cameras. They have instruments that they can analyze the chemical content of the rocks. And then the way we set it up to simulate the kind of communications we'll have with Mars, when we go to Mars, unlike the moon, where two people landed on the moon and they were both out doing a spacewalk together and there was nobody left in the lunar lander, but almost for sure we're going to have a much larger crew go to Mars. So you might have two people out exploring and looking for rocks and potentially for life, and you'll have at least two people back in the base. And since they're relatively close, they'll be able to communicate in real time. So we have two people who are sort of closeted in a separate room. They can't talk to anybody else back at the base because we're simulating that they are the ground crew on Mars. And then we have all the other scientists in the equivalent of mission control. But what they do is they record all the conversations that are going on between the astronauts out on the volcano and the two people in the Mars base room, and then they play it back for the people in mission control 15 or 20 minutes later. We're trying to figure out how you can best get the most efficiency out of the advice that the scientists can give. There's a lot of other complications about it. I mean, we're also looking into what are the proper techniques, what sort of instruments are useful, but the primary thing is to try to simulate as closely as possible the communications, and to do it where you're really doing science. There have been many what we call these analog Mars exploration missions, but almost universally the quote unquote science is also simulated. So, you know, people will walk around, they'll bend over to pick up a rock to simulate what the astronauts would be doing, but they're not really making critical scientific decisions. And that really changes it when, you know, these are results which will be published in scientific journals, journals of volcanology and astrobiology. And so it's really important to learn how to maximize the scientific output given the constraints of the Mars kind of communication delay. So that's what this exercise is all about.
And a brief interruption to remind you, this is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. On Hawaii Island, you may listen to Island Issues every Sunday at 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country 107.7 FM and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. And then the interviews are posted as podcasts to lava1053.com and to koacountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. And a huge mahalo to Hawaiian ukulele and guitar at Queen Shops and on Ali'i Drive, right across from Hulahe'i Palace. They sponsor, and if you want to learn anything about ukulele and guitar, pop in there, talk to Uncle Luke. He's terrific. Today we are listening to part one of a two-part conversation with five-time space shuttle astronaut Jeff Hoffman. He was here on the island in November doing some work for NASA, and he's telling us about that. This week and next week, we'll also talk more about what the experience of being an astronaut was like. And as I was getting this ready to get it on the radio, wow, I was so reminded how joyful he is about being an astronaut, and this week and next week, we'll really show you that. I recorded this conversation with Jeff Hoffman up at Canada-France Hawaii Telescope in Waimea, and you might enjoy listening to last week's interview with Doug Simons, their executive director, about astronomy on the island and on Mauna Kea in particular. Let's get back to my conversation with Jeff Hoffman.
6 months ago, we had a similar exercise on the volcano fields, the lava fields at Craters of the Moon in Idaho. Very different terrain from here on the volcano. So we learned a lot there, and we're learning even more here.
So the exercise inside Hawaii Volcanoes National Park on Kilauea Volcano is about 2 weeks on Hawaii Island. And so then are you analyzing the data and information you get from that, and will there be something published that we can read at some point?
Some of the data gets analyzed in real time, and then, as in most field exercises, you go back to your universities and analyze the data, and eventually it will get published. I think most of this data gets published in fairly technical scientific journals, so I'm not sure how much of that. I mean, obviously it's accessible to anybody who wants to look at it, but it's not the sort of thing that the average person, you know, picks up on their newsstand.
So talking about going to Mars, how realistic do you think it is that we in America will have a mission to Mars, and when might that occur?
Well, it's an enthusiastic, I'm enthusiastic about the idea. Whether NASA's current budget can support a mission to Mars on the kind of timeline that they're talking about, doing it sometime in the 2030s, we'll have to see. But there's a lot of enthusiasm about Mars. I mean, the movie The Martian, and now there's this National Geographic series on a mission to Mars that's coming up. And you know, if there's enough public enthusiasm, and of course, a big difference now is, whereas in Apollo we went there as a competitive activity with the Russians, who was going to be first, now when you look at the International Space Station, spacefaring nations around the world are cooperating, and hopefully that cooperation can extend to exploration beyond the Earth. I think it's very likely that we'll probably end up going to the moon before we go to Mars with people, even though that's not currently NASA's policy, but that's a whole other question, which probably too complex to get into here. But all the other spacefaring nations would like to go to the moon, and I would love to see our country, which is the one country that's been there. We could really organize an international lunar exploration initiative, which then could go on to become a Mars exploration initiative, because it's not going to be cheap. I mean, it was expensive going to the moon, and Mars is a lot farther away. And to get nations all over the world to contribute expertise and resources, I think ultimately is what we're going to have to do if, as a species, we're going to get to Mars and explore it and set up scientific bases. But it's worth doing. I mean, everything that we've learned about Mars from our robotic explorers, which have been great. I mean, I was an astronaut. I was involved with human spaceflight, but I love robots in space. I mean, I'm never going to get to the surface of Mars, but the robots have sent back pictures and data, which give us a pretty good idea of what it's like there. And, you know, the more we learn about Mars, the more fascinating it is. And it seems like early in the history of the planetary system, Mars was a very different place. It seems like it was much warmer. It had a thicker atmosphere, liquid water on its surface. And everywhere on the Earth where we find liquid water, we find life. And life evolved pretty soon on the Earth after the conditions allowed it. And if those conditions existed on Mars, maybe life evolved there. There certainly doesn't seem to be any life on the surface of Mars, but who knows, deep beneath the surface, there might still be microbes, or there might not, and there might be fossils, but whatever, we've got to go explore. And exploring for microbial life is just something that's really, really difficult with robots, the kind of robotic technologies that we have available now anyway. And so I think that will be a real motivation eventually for sending people there to explore Mars as well as is humanly possible, so to speak, with humans.
Well, you're an astronaut, so you have certainly a certain bent. Why is it important for us to explore other planets? Why is it important for us to have a space program?
Well, there's many different reasons. I look in some cases on astronomy as a cultural activity. It expands our minds. The idea of who we are, where our place is in the universe, these are things which fascinate people. But I think it goes beyond that. The development of space technology, which, you know, when we did it originally, there were various reasons, again, competitive exploration. But at this point, space has become part of the Earth's economic zone. I mean, geostationary orbit is just chock full of communication satellites without which life would be very different here on Earth. I look forward to the time someday when the moon becomes part of the Earth's economic sphere. Before that can happen, you have to explore it. We need to do a survey. What are the resources there? And Mars being that much further away, I think, at least for the foreseeable future, we'll be going there basically to explore, to try to learn about Mars. It's really important if we want to understand the Earth as a planet, to understand other planets. People worry about global warming now. Well, global warming and the greenhouse effect was really discovered on Venus, which, I mean, when I was a kid, there were all these science fiction stories and, you know, the Venus below the clouds was a lush jungle with, you know, all sorts of teeming with life. And then when we actually bounced radio signals off it and found out that the surface temperature was about 900 degrees Fahrenheit, then people realized that somehow or other it had a runaway greenhouse effect. You know, Venus shouldn't be nearly that hot. It's very similar to Earth. Yeah, it's a little bit closer to the sun, but, you know, what happened? Could something like that happen to Earth? Mars is just the opposite. It probably started out very much like the Earth, and now it's a dry desert. You know, what drives planetary dynamics is critical for us to basically manage our own planet, and we've learned a lot about that by studying other planets.
You know, the other thing, my recollection is during the NASA space program, during the early years, there were a lot of scientific discoveries made on the voyages themselves that have really gone on to benefit mankind in medicine and all kinds of things. Is that not so?
Well, there's no question. When you have, I mean, the resources that went into the Apollo program and the new technology that had to be developed had an enormous impact on our economy. I mean, now microcomputers, the technology is not driven by NASA anymore because the gaming industry and all the other uses of microcomputers are so much, you know, much a larger part of our economy. But you have to look back to how did it all get started. A lot of that got started as part of the space program. Whenever you devote large resources to developing complex technological projects, you're almost bound to have developments which ultimately enter the economy. And, you know, many people have studied the econometrics of the investment in our space program, and they universally come up with, for every dollar that you invest, you get many dollars worth of return into the economy.
You've talked about repairing the Hubble Space Telescope, which you said was a pretty cool part of your astronaut experience. So does that mean you actually did a spacewalk in a spacesuit and you were out there doing it in that way?
Three spacewalks, actually. As a crew, we did five. It was unique. No mission had ever done five spacewalks before. And normally we send two people out on each spacewalk. And people felt that, you know, for two people to go out 5 days in a row could be a bit much. I mean, I think I probably could have done it, but in any case, there were two teams. So I went out on days 1, 3, and 5, and the other team went out on days 2 and 4. It was the most complex shuttle mission and spacewalking mission that NASA had ever attempted. In fact, many people thought that NASA had bit off more than they could chew, really. And so when it was successful, it had many consequences, because not only did it rescue the Hubble Space Telescope, but it really demonstrated that astronauts in spacesuits could do the sort of critical work that we knew eventually would be necessary when we started to build the International Space Station. And in fact, I remember as a crew, during the late phases of our training, we were up at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, because that's where they had some of the instruments that we were going to put into Hubble, and they had a lot of the high fidelity models that we were training with. And we got called to NASA headquarters, and I always remember sitting across the desk from Dan Golden, who was the NASA administrator at the time, and he looked at us in the eye and said, "I hope you realize that the future of NASA's human space program depends on the success of your mission." So, yeah, you know, no pressure, right?
That would be pretty scary.
Well, you talk about scary. I mean, there's many people asked us, you know, don't you get scared riding on a rocket or, you know, doing this space mission? I think the only thing that we were really scared of was that we were not going to be successful. You know, the idea of what it takes to sit on top of 4.5 million pounds of high explosive on the launch pad, you do need the right sort of personality. And the way I approach that is that, you know, we train a lot for many things that can go wrong. And during launch, there are a large number of things that can go wrong, many of which we can do something about. And I was always confident that if one of those things happened, we were well enough trained that we would do the right thing. There are also, as we saw in Challenger, many things that can happen that you can't do anything about. My personality is, if I can't do anything about it, I'm not going to waste time worrying, and that's probably the right kind of personality. If, as I say, if sitting on top of 4.5 million pounds of high explosive causes you a lot of emotional distress, maybe you're in the wrong business.
So on the spacewalks on Hubble, what was it like? You leave the spaceship, and then what are you looking at? What are you seeing? We've all seen, well, many of us who were around at the time the space missions were on, you know, we got to see whatever was televised. But we've all seen movies that depict the movie image of doing a spacewalk. Tell us what it's really like since you've done it.
Well, one of the things when we made a movie of our mission, we had to actually speed up the videos mostly by a factor of 2, 3, or 4 times, because otherwise it would be moving so slowly that you couldn't bear to look at it. We move very slowly in general, particularly when we're carrying around heavy objects. You know, there's no gravity. Well, I shouldn't say there's no gravity. There's no weight up there. There is gravity in orbit, because if there wasn't, you wouldn't be in orbit. You'd go shooting off in a straight line. But things don't have any weight, but they do have mass, including your own body. And if things get moving too fast, then they're hard to control. So we always tell the rookie spacewalkers, move slowly. The slower you move, the faster you'll get your job done. There were many things that were wrong with Hubble. It wasn't just that it couldn't focus properly. They had problems with the solar panels. They had circuit breakers, which we had to replace, gyroscopes, which had broken. There were about a dozen different things that we had to fix. And we had rehearsed these extensively doing underwater training, which is where, for spacewalking, we go underwater, because a spacesuit on the Earth weighs about 300 pounds. And so if you're just trying to stand in a room and walking around, you really can't do anything. But underwater, of course, it's filled with air, and so it wants to float up to the surface. And so we put lead weights on our chest and our arms and our legs just to balance out that buoyancy, so we don't float but we don't sink. And actually, it's remarkably lifelike in terms of the training that you can get for being out in space. And we rehearsed all the things we had to do. And Hubble was designed to be serviced, which without that, there's no way that we could have done all the things that we did. So instruments were designed so that if something broke, you could remove them and put in new ones. I mean, it's remarkable. Of course, we were the first repair mission, and we were actually the rescue mission because Hubble, after it was put in orbit, it was discovered it couldn't focus. That's another thing that for younger people who didn't live through it, it's hard to bring back the total distress. I mean, it was a disaster. I mean, Hubble was the butt of jokes by late-night comedians. It was denounced in the halls of Congress as a techno-turkey. You know, NASA wanted Congress to approve the International Space Station, and NASA was not very popular with Congress at that time. I mean, here was this billion-dollar piece of space junk up there. And so it was a really critical mission. We took up a new camera, which I installed, and that is the camera that actually has taken a lot of the spectacular pictures that have come back from Hubble. And really, after the repair, Hubble's become the most well-known and popular telescope in the whole world. It's very precise.
And we're going to take a pause in our conversation with Jeff Hoffman and resume next week with some of the challenges of actually doing the repair of the Hubble Space Telescope without making things worse, and also talk more with Jeff about the actual experience of being in space. As I mentioned at the start of today's broadcast, Jeff shares amazing joy, and it was such a pleasure to re-listen to the interview as I was getting it ready to air. This is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken. We're sponsored by Hawaiian Ukulele and Guitar at Queen's Shops on Ali'i Drive and at Queen's Shops. I will see you next Sunday morning for part two of our conversation with Jeff Hoffman. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us, info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.